Hi, Richard Feidler here. Thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are many, many more at abc.net.au/conversations.
Welcome back to Conversations. My name's Trent Dalton. My guest today is an ordinary Brisbane boy made good. Made very good. By his mid-20s, Morgan Parker was working in Asia for Macquarie Bank, brokering massive deals in the same rarefied air as the super rich. Forget millionaires. He moved in the circles of billionaires. Then something extraordinary happened to Morgan Parker. Where once he used his brain to find ways to multiply his money, he began researching ways to methodically squander his fortune. He soon realised there was only one option available to him. A cracking big adventure. A 4-month motorbike marathon ride across 10 countries, from Hong Kong to Brisbane. If you think this story smells of millionaire adventure balloonist, you're only half right. Morgan Parker, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Morgan, what's the difference between a millionaire and a billionaire?
Well, I guess a millionaire flies at the front of a plane. A billionaire flies in their own plane.
That's a wonderful comparison. Morgan, where's home for you?
These days, home is Hong Kong. In Asia, that's the seventh home I've had in the last 15 years, but I always call Australia home.
What's back home for you?
Brisbane is a city that I grew up in and is always going to be my spiritual home. Hong Kong is where I live with my family, and given my penchant for living in the present, I always like to try and make home wherever I am. And as they say, home is where the heart is, and my heart is very much in Hong Kong right now.
What's it like adjusting back to Australia sometimes?
Very difficult. Over the last 16 years that I've been living outside of Australia, I've seen tremendous changes in this country. So often when I return for the brief visits, it feels like I'm a foreigner in my own country.
In what ways?
I think Australia has changed from an image when I was growing up of a bronzed Aussie on Bondi Beach and a laid-back culture to being something a little different from that these days. It's an environment where I've seen a relentless degrading, I guess, of civil liberties over time through excessive regulation that creeps in. And when you live in Asia, you see the opposite end of the spectrum, where there's a laissez-faire attitude to life and anything goes, and that has its own problems. But here there seems to have been a systematic dismantling of personal responsibility and individual accountability. And I see that when I talk to the youth in Australia, a real change that's taken place here socially.
Let's go right back. Morgan, what was the defining moment of your own childhood?
I think I changed as a child very much when, as many Australian homes these days end up breaking up and becoming atypical, and perhaps that's typical now to be atypical, but my parents separated when I was 13, and my older brother and sister had graduated from school and moved on with their own lives, so I was left going from a family of five to a family of two, just my mother and I. She was working a couple of jobs to make ends meet, and I was sort of left to my own devices, which could be dangerous for a 13-year-old boy, but I guess I responded in a way of taking on some additional responsibility around the house and just sort of grew up really quickly and applied myself to my schooling and just quickly wanted to become an adult so that I could contribute as best I could.
You really became the man of the house.
In some senses, yes, and I think a lot of people take on that responsibility when they're backed into a corner and they lose the father figure in their life on a daily basis.
What did you study?
I studied law at university. And that was a passion of mine as a younger kid. I always wanted to be a doctor or a lawyer, which was fashionable in those days. I think it's changed now. But I went to law school, which was a terrific experience, and all those skills that you learn in the course of a degree like that have helped me throughout my life. Of course, at the end of that, though, I had no intention of becoming a lawyer.
Of course, you chucked it all in and moved into real estate. Why?
Real estate to me was a family passion. My father was an architect, and so I grew up as a very young boy at the edge of his drafting table watching him conceive of things like the Brisbane airport, which he was involved in, and the law courts in Brisbane, and projects overseas in Asia as well, which was my first taste of Asia. But what attracted me to the property business was its very tangible nature. As a lawyer or a banker or something like that, you're really just shuffling papers around, and that wasn't appealing to me. I love the fact that as a developer of property, you could years later go past it and look at what you've created. So I moved straight into real estate after law school. I got a terrific piece of advice from my then stepfather, who was a property developer, and he said, if you want to learn about the property business, don't become a developer straight away. Go and work for the banks that lend money to them. And that led me into finance, and that was the beginning of the journey.
How did you end up in Asia?
In 1995, I was sitting in the boardroom at Macquarie Bank in Sydney, and my big boss at the time, who I'd only met on a few occasions, said to the assembled group of real estate investment bankers, which I was a junior one of, is anyone interested in going to Indonesia? We're going to start a business there. The room was silent, and I was sitting at the back, and I put up my hand and said I'd be interested, and he effectively ignored me. The meeting ended. A couple of weeks later, he came to me and said, Morgan, are you still interested in going to Indonesia? And I said, sure I am. And he said, well, you're not our first choice. You're not even our second choice. You're probably about our fifth choice. But all the senior guys that we want to send up there aren't interested, so I'm going to give you a shot.
Well, thanks, boss.
That was a Thursday, and I moved to Jakarta on the Monday.
It's somewhat naive, but it's also adventurous. What were you expecting?
I really didn't know. I expected Asia to be dynamic. I knew enough to know that that part of the world was going through tremendous growth. And of course, this is before the 1997 Asian financial crisis. Things were really booming. And to me, it was just an adventure. And it's funny, as I reflect on it, that was probably the first big adventure, was putting my hand up and saying I would go. And I think those moments in life are the ones that begin to define your life when you reflect on them.
How did you end up finding yourself working with Paul Keating?
At the end of 1996, after Paul Keating had lost the federal election to John Howard, of course, and Macquarie Bank was clever enough to retain his services as a consultant, which is very typical for retired politicians, as did a number of other large Australian companies. And Paul Keating has tremendous relations throughout Asia Pacific, importantly in Indonesia as well. So he had offered to help Macquarie Bank develop its business interests throughout the region, and in particular in Indonesia. And I just happened to be Johnny on the spot, if you like, and was thrust up there into the middle of a deal that involved Paul Keating and a number of other important people in Indonesia. And it was a real learning curve. And I got to say, I'd only voted in one federal election at that point in my life, and I hate to say, it wasn't for Mr. Keating. However, after spending an extended period of time working with him, I left that experience having immense respect for the man. A real statesman, an incredible intellect, a real tactician, and I learned an enormous amount just being associated with him.
You're listening to Conversations with me, Trent Dalton. My guest is Wheel to Wheel founder Morgan Parker. Morgan, how did you end up in China?
In 1997, when the Asian financial crisis hit, one of the few economies that wasn't adversely affected was China. The currency crisis back then is a little bit different to the one we find ourselves in now, in that it was built around currencies. And the renminbi, the currency in China, is non-convertible, meaning that there couldn't be speculation on it and undue influencing from outside influences. So we built a business in China, in Macquarie Bank, that was developing very nicely. The business in Indonesia that I was involved in had come to a dramatic end, quite abruptly also, with President Suharto leaving office, and that really fundamentally changed the political and business landscape of Indonesia at the time. So I was fortunate enough to be asked to move to Tianjin, which is a 10-million person city. It was 1998, not long ago, but in Chinese history, that's a long time ago, particularly business history. Macquarie was one of the first foreign investors into Chinese real estate, and I was asked to go up there, and I found myself in Tianjin with about 35 local staff that had been hired before I arrived, and I was the only foreigner. I was reporting to the head office in Sydney, and I was told to manage the business, grow the business, and execute on these residential development projects that we were building. So a great platform, but wow, what a challenge. I think I was 23 years old or something, and I look back on it now thinking, how did I do that? How did I make it through? And if it wasn't for the support that I got from all my mentors in Macquarie Bank, I would never have been able to do it.
You're a young man with no Chinese language knowledge or little. How did you mix it with these millionaire Chinese businessmen?
You have to find things outside of the business environment to connect, because you simply can't connect on the basis of shared business experience, theirs being vast, mine being so limited. So I found ways to connect outside of work, which included, you know, eating. It sounds funny, but the Asian psyche is very much built around food. Families come together to eat. A lot of business is done around a dinner table or a lunch table. And I found ways of connecting with people that were vastly different to myself through a commonality of cuisine. And Chinese took great delight in feeding up to me all of these weird and wonderful dishes to see how I would react. And I stoically put them away, you know, snakes and lizards and locusts and scorpions and you name it. I ate it, all in the name of getting the job done.
Is there a great drinking culture among these businessmen?
Absolutely. None of the restrictions that you might see in more developed countries applied in those days in China. So it wasn't unusual to be having what they call baijiu, which is this rice wine, incredibly toxic alcohol, at 11 o'clock in the morning. Of course, I assumed that they were trying to get some unfair advantage over me by making me drunk. But I was able to hold my own, thankfully. But there was many tipsy meetings that took place after a meal.
What did you notice about what was important to these men?
In China in those days, and I think in Asia generally, there is a real national pride. There's a community spirit that is very robust. And what I found all these businessmen are trying to do is not only improve their own lot in life, but also make good and be proud about what they can achieve and show the rest of the world that China, in that case, was developing, was worthy of investment, and was a force to be reckoned with. So you meet these people in these countries and you're struck by their passion for their business and their enthusiasm to impress upon you the fact that they're doing good. And it's a slightly different culture to more developed countries like Australia, but infectious nonetheless. And I really got into that passion and I think learned a lot from interacting with those local people.
You were there just as it was about to explode. What do you remember from that time about what China felt and looked like?
I remember incredible change. The streets changed. People's dress changed. When I arrived, people were still wearing the communist garb of Chairman Mao. You know, men and women walking around in just shades of grey. And combined with the weather that at nighttime was negative 30 degrees, in the daytime, in the shade, was negative 10. This backdrop was very dull and Stalinistic, like you'd imagine 1960s Russia to be. And here we are at the end of the 20th century, and that's China. But even in the space of months, you see changes that might take place over years in a more developed nation. And one of those changes was the advent of McDonald's coming to Tianjin. And I happened to be there when McDonald's arrived. And this is a momentous occasion in any Chinese city's history. And I'll never forget the day it opened. It was a Saturday, obviously to maximise the appeal and the ability for people to come, not being a work day. And the line stretched for hundreds of metres around the corner. And, of course, the 100 foreigners that lived in the city, 99 of which worked for Motorola, who were building those little Oyster mobile phones back in the day, haven't they gone away?
Thankfully.
And me. And so they were all in the line, and I joined the line, and we're joined by thousands of ordinary Chinese lining up to get a look at this Western icon and experience the Big Mac.
How far had you travelled for that, possibly?
Well, ironically, it wasn't too far from where I was living. But it was a long wait and a very, very cold day. I think it was about negative 15 degrees that day, standing there for a couple of hours to get a chance at a Big Mac. But of course, after you've been living there for a year, eating congee and a 1,000-year-old egg for breakfast every day, you're pretty ready for your Big Mac.
That Western fatty goodness. You found yourself in Korea on 9/11.
Yes, after working in China and via Singapore and Taiwan and a number of other places, I did find myself in Korea in 2001. And Korea, of course, was a very different proposition to a lot of the other places I'd lived. Very closed environment. Korean culture is hard to get a take on. They're sandwiched between two superpowers, on Japan on one side with a very robust culture and, of course, China on the other side. So you could imagine the sort of social and economic complexes that exist in that environment. But nonetheless, a very attractive environment for foreign investment. I lived in an area called Hanamdong, which is only a matter of a few hundred metres away from the US military base, which is effectively in the centre of Seoul. Quite strange to have such a big base right in the centre of one of the world's biggest cities. The population of Seoul is sort of 11, 12, 13 million people, and right smack bang in the middle of it, you've got 35,000 military personnel and Department of Defense personnel. Of course, a hangover from the Korean War in the 1950s. I think it's the second largest base in the world after the US base in Germany. And, of course, when 9/11 occurred, the military response was to go to DEFCON 4, which is a state of immediate readiness for war. And I remember those days well because no one really knew what was going to happen. We didn't know whether 9/11 was a one-off event or it was the beginning of a chain of events. We didn't know what was going to happen in Afghanistan and Iraq, which were presumed to be possibly behind it in some way. And there was a whole lot of speculation going around. And Korea being, you know, in its geographic location was deemed to be of strategic importance to be ready. So you went from this environment where you had all these people out on the streets to now being confined to base. And the whole sentiment of that city changed overnight. Like literally overnight, all these people disappeared. Bars and restaurants that were favourites of the personnel on base previously closed. And the city was cold, dark and quiet. Quite an eerie feeling to occur, and here we are halfway around the world from where the event actually took place.
What a surreal moment in your life. Morgan, all along the way, you're picking up lots of money, making lots of money for yourself. Tell me about your friends at the time. What sort of lunches were you having?
Well, the decadence that exists in corporate life is global. It happens everywhere. You know, lunches could be $10,000 or $15,000. And take 3 or 4 hours. You know, you just lose all sense of what's life's all about.
What could you possibly be having at a $15,000 lunch?
Wine. Wine and lots of food. And, you know, there's a market for that type of dining, as there is for most consumption of most different products in the world. And when one group moves away from that, there's always another group ready to take it up. And, you know, there are a lot of fine restaurants around the world. You know, the sort of decadence I've seen is people getting on a private jet, flying across the Atlantic for lunch. This is happening right here and now.
Hopefully not just for a Big Mac.
Not for a Big Mac, no. It'd be an expensive Big Mac. But, you know, there's a lot of extreme wealth that exists in the world, and I've had, I guess, the fortune to witness that, albeit not directly experience it, having that wealth myself, of course, but working with people of incredible wealth really opened my eyes to what exists out there, and I think set the framework for what was going to happen later in my life.
How did you fit into this group?
I think, you know, you've always got to demonstrate value to those around you. And when you're working directly with billionaires and very powerful people, they're looking for enthusiasm, ambition, and, you know, intellect and capability. And just, you know, one of the best pieces of advice I ever got when I was working at Morgan Stanley was from my boss. He said, "Morgan, the world's full of smart people. What's really important to get your head in life is that people like you." And that's a great piece of advice for people out there who are looking to get ahead. A lot of the time we focus on academic prowess or even commercial experience. But a lot of what creates success in life and creates charisma, if you like, is people just enjoying being around you. And I think Australians have done a wonderful job abroad of endearing themselves to others in the commercial environment. And you now see many Australians working in wonderful jobs, exercising a lot of influence over world events. We may not see or hear about it, but I meet a lot of them in the strangest corners of the world, in boardrooms in New York or in a bar in London after work. But there are a lot of people out there doing a lot of good stuff.
One great family you endeared yourself to was the Taubmans.
The Taubman family I met in 2005, a very successful family who have interests in real estate, in Sotheby's, the art auction house, in banks, and all manner of different businesses. And they provided me with a great opportunity. I left Morgan Stanley at the time where I had a wonderful career. I was working in Tokyo, enjoying life, and they pulled me out of that and asked me to build a real estate business with them in Asia. And that was a wonderful experience for me. They not only are terrific business people, but also opened my eyes for the first time to large-scale philanthropy. And through my time working with them, I saw the way in which the uber-wealthy, particularly in the United States, have become incredibly strategic about the way they invest their money in philanthropic causes. So we may focus on the money that these people have, but if you look at people like Buffett and Gates, who have incredible philanthropic programs that they're working through now, these people are really turning that money that they've been given into a lot of positive outcomes. And to the extent that the Taubman family does that, they've been able to create a lot of positive outcomes as well. And by witnessing what they do, it gave me a lot of ideas as well.
Of course, Taubman was the founder, essentially, of the shopping mall in the United States. I mean, this is really the super rich. What did that family teach you about the strategy of philanthropy?
Well, first off, I learned that it was important to be proactive about what you do. Up until that point in time, I had been a reactive, charitable person. Someone had said, "Morgan, come along to this ball," and I would go, you know, pay the ticket like we all do. Or a friend would be doing a fun run and say, "Hey, can you sponsor me to do the fun run? All the proceeds are going to charity." I'd do that. Or even on the street corner, someone would shake a tin in your face on a Saturday morning and say, "Give to this cause," and I'd pop a few coins in there. Now, that's reactive philanthropy. And that's not bad, but I wanted to get a little bit more strategic. So I looked at the way that they'd been doing, and they sort of looked at the range of issues that were really important to them, humanitarian issues, and said, "Well, we're focused on this area, and this area. Now we're going to go about finding organizations or people that we believe in that are actually being effective in those areas. So start with the macro issues and then work out which organizations to support." So I took a leaf out of the Taubman book and started researching different humanitarian issues that I felt passionately about in Asia and in Australia, and then spent a couple of years researching those issues and finding organizations that resonated with me.
You founded Wheel to Wheel. What is Wheel to Wheel?
Wheel to Wheel it started out as a pretty strange idea. It's a little bit innovative, I guess, and I was looking for a fun way to get involved in philanthropy. I didn't want to just do what I'd been doing and writing checks out and donating. So I talked to these organizations and listened to what they were saying. And what I learned was that smaller charitable organisations are really struggling to attract people's attention. As we all know, there's so many charities out there doing so much work. It's hard for someone sitting back and saying, well, who do I give my money to? How do we work out which ones are effective, which ones are going to use my money for the benefit of the people that are supposed to be getting the money? We've all heard the stories about giving to larger charitable organisations. You give them a dollar and supposedly 60 cents is lost in administration, all that sort of stuff. So I thought, I've got to try and find a way of cutting through this. So taking both sides of that story, the charitable side to start with, I thought, well, I can help charities get more attention. And then on the donor side, I can help donors cut through all of the noise about which charities are doing well and which ones are not doing so well, and provide them with some due diligence and research to help make informed decisions. So Wheel to Wheel is really that intermediary between the two.
Conversations on ABC Local Radio.
Morgan, you were telling me about how you go about selecting which charities to support.
The team and myself at Wheel to Wheel spent a couple of years researching over 350 charitable organisations and whittled that down to a final 10, one in each of the countries I travelled through on my motorbike expedition, the idea being to visit each one of these organisations. The criteria was built around finding grassroots organisations coming from the ground up, small organisations that with a little bit of help could do much more, and organisations that had proven to be effective in tackling the issue and efficient with the support that they're given. And finally, finding organisations that had a passionate leader or group of leaders that you could really connect to, because after all, at the heart of all these issues are people, and it's people that make the difference in the world.
Why a four-month marathon, 10-country motorbike crazy ride?
It just seemed like a good idea at the time. I wanted to combine, my passion for adventure and with an event that could capture people's imagination. And I had seen the success that the Long Way Round that Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman did. That had created a lot of interest back in 2005, 2006. And the idea of travelling and roaming the world on a motorbike to me just seemed right at the time. So much of the world now is discovered, of course, with GPS and the population being so large and people basically living on every inch of the earth. It's hard to find a way to actually see and immerse yourself in all of these different cultures throughout the world. Travelling on a motorbike is so much different to a car or a bus or a truck or an aeroplane, of course, because you're viscerally connected to what you're doing. All your senses are heightened. Not only are you in that alpha mindset of being completely alert on the road, one move and you could be off, but you're also exposed to the air, to the smells, and boy, does Asia have some smells. You can also hear what's going on around you. In a car, you're sort of sealed in, maybe listening to the radio and air conditioning. I was out there feeling the climate, the environment. You could feel the people watching you as you went past. You could even touch them as you rubbed up against each other.
Did you have an open face helmet?
At times I had my face exposed, but even when it's not, you can really still sense everything that's going on around you. There are quite a few pungent odours that are throughout Asia. So it was a great way to travel and really get a sense of what was going on. A completely different experience.
How much riding experience had you had prior to the adventure?
Well, here's the thing. I had very little. I was a terrible motorbike rider. A lot of people who ride motorbikes have had a passion for it for many, many years, and I didn't. I started riding motorbikes when I was 32. I'm 37 now, so I guess I've got 5 years' experience. But when I decided to do it, I realized I really needed to get my riding skills up to scratch or I was going to kill myself. So one of my friends here in Australia decided to take me under his wing, and he took me out into the bush, and we rode around and learnt how to handle the bike, albeit a different bike. So by the time I left on the expedition earlier in 2011, I felt relatively comfortable and confident that I could make it. But there was still enough of a question mark there to have a few people worried, including my mother.
Of course. What sort of bike did you ride?
I rode a BMW F800 GS.
What is that? Is that bigger than a police bike?
It's pretty big. It's not the biggest bike in that family, but I guess you could call it a hybrid. It's sort of half on-road, half off-road. Of the 25,000 kilometres between Hong Kong and Brisbane that I rode, about 7,000 of it was off-road. And not by choice sometimes. Of course, I like to take the road less travelled on occasion, but in some countries, the roads are dirt. The main roads are dirt. So to get from point A to point B meant being able to handle the bike on dirt and gravel and in all sorts of terrain. So this bike was ideal for that sort of journey that I was doing.
Of course, the thing about the road less travelled is that it often leads to trouble.
Yeah, there was plenty of moments. I probably died a few times. There were probably 6 or 7 occasions where I really shouldn't have made it. They were concentrated in Indonesia.
What were the worst of those?
Yeah. Head-on collisions with trucks where we both slammed on our brakes and ended up actually touching each other, but only, you know, just a slight touch because we both applied the brakes soon enough.
Just in time.
Like the trucks there go up the wrong side of the road at night with no lights on. So it's hard, you know, you're coming up over the crest, a motorbike's just got one headlight, and you can imagine, like, off in the distance, you just start to see an image emerge, and you think, oh, that's a truck, and that's coming straight for me. So you flash, you move out of the way, and you sort of avoid death that way. But these roads through Asia are very dense, and they're the lifeblood of these economies. You know, people conveying back and forth, trucks, buses. You know, people live on these roads. Their life takes place on the road. It's a very different culture in the way in which people live. They're out there on the road, chickens, goats, cows, horses. When I got to Australia, I was dealing with kangaroos and emus and camels. So it can be dangerous.
4 months of this intense, physically and emotionally taxing ride, did you ever want to pack it in?
On day 16, I was travelling in northern Laos and it had been raining for a couple of weeks, which was unseasonable. I picked this window of time because it was the best window in terms of temperature being as cool as possible and precipitation being as low as possible. But as we all know with Mother Nature, she has surprises for us in store. So I arrived in northern Laos and the ambient temperature was about 6 degrees. The rain was coming in at 45 degrees angle, and I was up in the mountains, so the effective temperature was below zero. And the government in Laos is building a national network of roads. There's only really one road in the country at the moment, goes from top to bottom. The rest is peripheral. And one road is going from dirt to bitumen. So they've got a road base, and that road base is made of clay. And when clay has had a couple of weeks of water on it, it becomes pretty slippery. So I was supposed to travel 150 kilometres that day, and which was a very achievable objective. And at the end of that, I was opening a school with our charity Child's Dream, which was a tremendous honour and probably one of the highlights of the trip. So by the time the day ended, I'd been riding 15 hours. I'd dropped the bike 40 times. I'd injured myself all over, black and blue. One car had slid off the side of a cliff that was following me. The four-wheel drive that was carrying the film crew and another four-wheel drive that was carrying the charity.
You were filming the trip, yep.
Were filming, yeah. Mm-hmm. They couldn't make it. And I had to walk about 2 kilometres at the end of the day to try and find somewhere to sleep. And I'd made it to the halfway lunchtime point.
That was only halfway.
And that was 15 hours of riding. So at the end of that day, to be fair to say that I was at the limit. And I really discovered in myself whole new regions of my personality and character. And I reflected a lot on my family who'd supported me so much and my friends to get to that point. And also the charities that I was doing it for. And it's when you find those extraneous reasons to go on that I at least find more strength. So I wouldn't say it was an inner strength that kept me going and not quitting. It was actually the desire that I had to deliver to those other people that had shown so much support for me.
You must have really faced some hard truths about yourself.
Yeah, I actually discovered that I was capable of more than I thought. Here I am being effectively a white-collar worker my whole life, you know, not really getting my hands dirty as much as I'd like. And we all have strength in us, and I think that's the takeaway from that day. And those that witnessed that day and that will see it eventually in the television series, I hope will take away a conviction that they're capable of more themselves. If we're really put to the challenge, which very few of us are during the course of our life, you can find something in you that enables you to go further than you ever imagined you could.
Some people might say the adventure was more about you and not the charities. Why not just drop the money straight into a bank account?
Well, I created this idea in my head that philanthropy, like the business world that I'd left behind, could be leveraged. And I figured that instead of just writing a check and giving it to each one of the 10 organizations, that if I spent the same amount of money creating a documentary television series that showcased the work that these 10 organizations are doing and broadcast that as far and wide as I could, that hopefully that would create an exponential return for those charities. So what I did is I hired a film crew in Hong Kong, and they followed me for large portions of the trip, particularly when I was intersecting with the 10 charities along the route. And we created some wonderful television around what they're doing and spent a lot of time learning about the issue and how they've been effective in dealing with it and showcasing that work, so that when that gets broadcast in 2012, I think that you're going to see an enormous uplift for those 10 organizations, not only in people knowing they exist, but also feeling inclined to give to them. So I'm hoping that every dollar that I put into making this happen is going to end up being $5 to them. So effectively creating that leverage philanthropy. At least that's the hope.
Let's talk about some of these charities. Who did you find in Thailand to support?
In Thailand, we found an organization called Ban Gerda, which is a HIV/AIDS homestay orphanage. And what was special about that decision was the fact that we were intent on doing something in the HIV/AIDS space. And that was even before the expedition was dreamt of. I wanted to be involved in that issue. I didn't know how to get involved in it and where the issue was at. Most of us have lived with the idea of HIV/AIDS being out there for 20 or 30 years. We roughly know how to prevent it. We sort of know how it happens. And these days, most people are aware of the fact that there are drugs that can be taken to stay the onset of full-blown AIDS and enable HIV-infected patients to actually live a relatively full life. So knowing all of that, I thought, well, where's this issue at and how can I get involved in it and try and make a difference? So I found this organization in Thailand that has got 83 kids living there. They've been living there since they were infants. All of them have lost their parents to AIDS. And they're living in these home environments, going to school, learning arts and crafts, sports, music, language, you name it. They can speak English, for example. And the modus operandi of this organization is to allow these kids to re-enter society as adults eventually and live a productive and constructive life contributing to the community. And what I learned from my time there on the expedition was that it's really only our stigma that we have towards people with HIV/AIDS that is holding them back. Because of the advancements in medicine, these people outwardly are completely normal. We played some footy with them. We took an AFL football there and gave it to them and kicked it around. We tackled each other. We played for hours out in the paddock. And these kids are as tough as any Australian kid of the same age. Quite amazing. I must admit, when I went there, I had no idea what to expect. I was thinking frail, weak, sickly-looking people. Absolutely not. I was totally wrong. And I came away thinking, these kids are just normal. They're just kids living with a terrible illness that they got through no fault of their own. And it's only us that's holding them back.
You're listening to Morgan Parker talking about leveraged philanthropy on Conversations. Morgan, what did you experience in Timor?
East Timor was the ninth country I passed through. So by then I was getting pretty weary. I was delighted to be out of Indonesia, which had the toughest riding conditions. I'd been in Indonesia a whole month going from the very northern tip of Bandai Aceh, where the tsunami hit all those years ago, right across to Timor. And it was a hell of a journey, I tell you. Getting into East Timor was like this breath of fresh air, the world's newest nation, a young, dynamic population looking to get ahead. And after breaking free of Indonesia and going through all the pain of that separation, I found this vibrancy that was really alluring. We also had an opportunity to meet the president, José Ramos Horta, who is an incredible historic figure, one of the founding fathers of East Timor, a Nobel Peace Prize winner. He lived in exile in New York, pleading the case for independence from Indonesia in front of the Security Council of the United Nations. An incredible man. And he said to me one day, you know, when we got there, he said, oh, why don't you come around to my house and have a couple of beers on Sunday afternoon? And here I am thinking, this is amazing.
Like, what an invitation.
He had heard through a number of other Australians that knew him about Wheel to Wheel and had taken a real interest in the expedition I was doing. I had no idea that we would be ever able to get the attention of people like that. But he was so happy that we had elected to take the expedition through his country that he insisted that myself, the film crew, and my partner in Wheel to Wheel, Alan Ng, come around and chat with him on a Sunday afternoon at his residence. It was the greatest honour and an incredible 3 hours that I spent with him. I learned a lot about him as a man and the struggles that he went through. A lot of people think that a president or a head of state has had a charmed life and got there through all the right channels. But this guy really did it the hard way and went through a lot of sacrifices to make it, and is so passionate about the development of his country, so supportive of what the Australian government has done to help his country come into existence and find peace and stability, and so interested in what Wheel to Wheel was doing. We spent half the time talking about the expedition, my motorbike. He owns a motorbike. He's got a collection of cars that we chatted about. A really down-to-earth guy. And then we spent the second half of the meeting just chatting about East Timor. And he talked about East Timor, you know, like it was balancing his household budget.
Incredible.
He was talking about, you know, Morgan, we get this much from this source and we've got all these things we want to do over here. And what do you think we should do about the roads? I guess the roads are pretty bad. He said, what are the roads like? How do they compare to what you saw in Indonesia? Well, how do they compare what you saw in Malaysia and Thailand and Laos and Vietnam?
He's asking you for advice.
He's asking me what I thought of his road infrastructure. Of course, I've ridden through all these roads and I've now arrived in his country. I didn't have the heart to tell him that his roads were terrible, but I did say that they were lacking somewhat. And he reluctantly admitted, he said, yeah, I know, they're not so great, are they? But we'll get to those eventually. I've got to put an electricity grid in place first. And I just said, fair enough.
Morgan, how do you slow down from all these experiences? How do you move back to normal everyday life from having beers with José Ramos Horta?
You just look for the next challenge, and the next challenge is delivering on our charitable objective, which is to get this 10-episode television documentary series broadcast. There's a hell of a lot of work that goes into creating a piece like that, a series like that. So I'm spending my days now in post-production, sorting through the thousands of hours of footage to create some really compelling stories that help educate people.
Not only your days, your money.
And my money, yes. But I think that what we're going to do is create something that's very entertaining, but also somewhat surreptitiously delivers really important humanitarian messages about what's going on in the world out there and introduces these 10 heroic organisations that I think we should be celebrating. I'm hoping that as a result of this television broadcast, at least some people will go away thinking of a new value structure for themselves, that perhaps we should be spending more time supporting and creating opportunities for humanitarians to do their work. And if that means volunteering, then it means volunteering. Telling your friends can just be a start, or eventually even donating money. There's a humanitarian in every one of us. At the end of the day, we're all humans. We all inhabit this earth together, and we all have a collective responsibility for its welfare. It's only some people that have actually sacrificed what they're doing to actually go out and do it. And the people I met that run these charitable organisations have made enormous sacrifices to do what they're doing. You know, far more than anything I could ever imagine doing myself. They are really the champions here, and this series is about celebrating their work.
How was your body when you returned from the adventure?
I had shed 10 kilograms of weight. I wouldn't advocate this as a weight loss strategy. It was really tough on the road, finding food and just, you know, riding a bike. A riding day could be anywhere from 8 to 15 hours. And then it would involve looking for a place to sleep, looking for some food to eat, trying to wrangle all the data that I was dealing with, all the filming. I had 3 cameras on my bike. I was trying to make YouTube clips where I could to keep the community informed about where I was. They were really tough days. I slept 4 or 5 hours. And, of course, when you're not sleeping, all the problems the next day become amplified. And, you know, days turn to weeks, weeks turn to months. And you just get worn down. The attrition is significant. I was weak, frail by the end of it. But arriving in Brisbane after 125 days and doing 25,000 kilometres was one of the greatest moments of my life. Just knowing that I'd done it, I'd had people in my life close to me saying I wouldn't make it. And not that that was a motivation to prove them wrong, not at all. But I had a quiet moment to myself where I reflected on the fact that of what people had said, that it wouldn't be possible for me to do it, and took some pleasure, just quietly, about making it.
What did you say to yourself?
You can do more. Keep going. You're at the finish line of this expedition, but there's more you can do. This is what I'm here to do. Spread the word about what others are doing. Not everyone can be a humanitarian hero. My part in this story is just to help others find the spotlight and point it in their direction. And I hope that the challenge that I put myself through will garner enough support and enough attention for people to see through that expedition to the real meaning, which is these 10 great stories that we're going to tell.
You've gained so much along the way, but what have you lost?
I've lost a way of life, which is terrifying to some. It was terrifying to me at different points, but you adjust. Human beings adjust. We're incredible at adjusting. And I've lost friends, people who used to be a part of my life, and I would love to continue to be a part of my life, now aren't. I was a guy that was a good time guy, you know, doing well and having fun, and, you know, life was a bit of a party. Anything was possible. And now I'm really focused on the philanthropic side of life, and I guess that's quite confronting to some people that have found a way not to be involved in the community and who are making a lot of money out there but are secretly sort of keeping it all to themselves and may be portraying themselves as an active community member but really aren't.
It's hard to have a $15,000 lunch when there's kids with AIDS in Thailand.
It's impossible to. It's absolutely impossible to go on in the way that you do when you open your eyes and see what's happening in the world. So for me, it wasn't necessarily a decision. It was more of a compulsion to do this. As soon as you become more aware of the world, aware of the environment, aware of these humanitarian issues, I think most people, given that opportunity to learn about it, would react the same way I have, and that is with an overwhelming desire to try and find a way to help. What I hope happens as a result of people learning more about Wheel to Wheel is that they find their own personal, unique way to get involved. That doesn't mean replicating what I've elected to do, but maybe doing something that makes sense for you and your family of how you can get involved, and think outside of the box. Anyone can stage an event. At the end of the day, what I've done is little more than really just what I said earlier about a guy doing a fun run. I just decided to make it a little bit more extravagant, a little bit bigger. But essentially what I've done is put on an event that yielded me a tremendous life experience, created enough interest for people to feel that they were going to donate money. Some of them maybe donated just to see whether I'd make it. Others looked through and saw the causes. But whatever the reason, it's created, you know, $250,000 so far of donations. With the television broadcast coming up in the next 6 months, I'm hoping that we can reach $1 million in donations for these 10 organisations. And we're already starting to see the impact of the money that's been passed through to them.
Morgan, just getting towards the end, what material treasures have you kept from the trip to remind you of this incredible adventure?
Well, in today's day and age, you can't go anywhere without photographs and video. I've got a film crew following me, so I've got a lot of reminders and reflections that are inescapable. It is a wonderful thing to have a documented expedition like this. I was lucky enough for my 8-year-old daughter, Aria, to join me on several points throughout the route, and in fact joined me for an 18-day spell, which took us overland from Cambodia into Thailand. What a magic experience for an 8-year-old kid.
Between a father and a daughter as well, though.
Exactly, exactly. And she visited two of the organisations, one in Cambodia and then the one in Thailand, at the beginning and end of that tour for her. So I'm continually reflecting on the trip. So it lives on inside me. In fact, in some occasions, I wake up in the middle of the night in Hong Kong in my bed thinking I'm in a tent in Laos and wondering where I'm riding to the next day. So it's very much with me, consciously and subconsciously. It's one of those experiences in life, I think, that will always be a part of my character now and forever.
Morgan, I've loved hearing about your trip and your life today. It's been a real eye-opener. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me. I've really enjoyed being here.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.